Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next edition of the VTX podcast. Here at the Veterinary Thought Exchange, we like to start by asking, what are you thinking? And this week, we're going to be thinking and chatting with the wonderful Sam. Now, I know we like to talk about squiggly veterinary careers, and I'm all for those, but I genuinely think that Sam epitomizes what that means. We talk about her amazing exploration into the world of CPR and training, but we start off by talking about joining the circus, and you'll need to listen more to join all of those incredible dots together. But for me, really the take-home message from chatting with Sam is that really we can do what we want with our veterinary careers. It doesn't always work out the way we think, but really we need to be empowered to take control and make our careers the careers that we really, really want them to be. And I think also remembering always that it's okay if it doesn't work out A, perfectly, or B, the way that we thought it would. So really massive thank you to Sam for chatting today. In our clinical segment, we continue our discussion about the management of acute diarrhea in dogs and continue that focus on moving away from using antibiotics in those cases. So I do hope you can join us for that too. Right, Sam, thanks so much for joining us this evening. I've been looking forward to this conversation because I think it's really interesting to kind of feel like you know something about someone because I follow what you do on social media and kind of how your career, you know, has progressed. But we have now met in person. We met at Vetstagram and London Vet Show maybe as well, actually. So that's a lie. We have. But again, before kind of the advent of social media, our careers have not crossed paths, so to speak. Nice. So it's really, really interesting and really nice to chat to you. So thank you for joining us. So I don't know if you want to start, just for the listeners, just telling us a little bit about you and your veterinary background, if that's okay.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Well, thank you for having me. It's very odd now that our career paths seem to be crossing when I'm not there anymore, which is really strange, isn't it? So a little bit about me. I never wanted to be a vet nurse. So I always feel like I need to get that out of the way because I feel a bit of a fraud when I say, I never wanted to be a vet nurse. I wanted to work with horses. Got told horses there was no money. Don't be stupid, don't do that. That was by my father. So ended up working in an equine practice because obviously nobody does what their parents tell them to do when you're 18. So you go and work with horses. And it got acquired. And during that conversation, I met a really lovely guy who actually is probably responsible for me being a vet nurse, if I'm honest, who said, you know, I know somewhere that needs a trainee nurse. And fab, off I trotted. Just kind of appeared. It was a very strange setup. And it was always with the intention to go back into equine. But when I was there, I worked with an incredible vet who gave me a bit of a taste for a referral. And I loved working with him. And pretty much, I think 3 months after qualifying, I went and interviewed at North Downs Referrals. And that's pretty much where I stayed. Yeah. I knew I wanted to go and work in referral. And I just thought, right, I'm going. And did it. Couldn't believe it when I got offered the job. It was there for quite a long time. Got a little bit stagnant. Wasn't a huge amount of change. It was still, I mean, probably relatively new in our profession, to be fair. So there wasn't a lot of opportunity. Dabbled again in primary care. Confirmed that it wasn't really for me at that point in my career. So I actually went up north to another referral hospital where I think our paths have kind of retrospectively crossed. So back it went to Chester Gates. Team leader up there. And then we just had a bit of a break. I went into teaching. So I took a role program managing vet nursing, taught vet nursing. So prior to that, I'd done like my ECC certificate, my graduate diploma from the Royal College, like was in it, loved it. I took management roles, enjoyed them as well. But yeah, went into teaching because I love teaching. And I think that's probably hopefully what the vibe people get from the stuff I do. But miss practice, but back to North Downs, because I'm a bit of a boomerang nurse, I think. I tend to be. And created roles for myself there, I guess, for want of a better word. I've been very privileged to work with people who have been very pro nurse development and empowering nurses to, you know, work to the absolute max of their skills. So left there just before COVID hit to take a role working for the company that owned them. So I've always liked ECC. I've always liked medical cases. I loved anaesthesia. So I guess I'd probably, referral nurse at heart would be probably my most accurate description, but someone who loves to teach as well.
So you do, so at the moment you're working in a more, you're working within one of the veterinary corporates. So what, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so what's your role? What role do you have in that capacity?
I started like managing a program for new qualified nurses.
Yeah.
So it was very apparent at my time at North Downs that newly qualified nurses obviously want to go into work in referral. But it's hugely overwhelming for them. It's overwhelming for most of us, to be fair. So, it was very much, that was my role there. So I originally worked for the corporate running that program for newly qualified nurses. I have recently moved into a medical quality manager role. So I actually work now within the quality team, the medical team, rather than the nursing team. Mainly because a lot of what I was delivering for the post-registration program was quality improvements, like auditing, human factors, significant events. So just really trying to give them all those extra skills. But I also work for the Royal College as well.
Right. So I see you on the road kind of dotting about. So do you go into practices and tell them how to be better? Is that a good summary? No? Terrible.
Tell them.
Oh, sorry. Show them the light, the way.
We have a lot of conversations, is what I say. So I am a practice standards assessor as well, which I'm always never sure if not I should tell people that, because some people have it's very Marmite. Some people are like, oh yay, and then other people are like, oh god. For me, I love it. I love chatting to people, I love meeting people. We have a lot of conversations around a lot of the clinical governance stuff, because for most people that's still a relatively new concept, and that generally is where the support is needed. So kind of work with practices from that angle, and then with like the medical quality team and the PRP was very much kind of looking at processes and how we can improve. So it's an open dialogue rather than telling.
So you're not doing clinical practice now?
No, not at the moment. So I was still, when COVID all kicked off, I was still in practice. Obviously, being pregnant during a pandemic, I would just work from home for a year. So, yeah, no touching of animals. I am really missing it. And I have actually kind of started, well, I have started making ways to kind of do one day a week back in practice.
I feel overwhelmed by the number of hats. I mean, there feels like, you do wear a lot of hats, but isn't that interesting? Four or five. Okay, we'll talk. Okay, we'll talk about the other ones. So I think my sort of feeling is that you have really genuinely lots of different hats that you wear now. So that can be one of two things: either you are creating this kind of role, which I love. You know, you've made the job kind of work for you, as far as I've picked this bit and this bit that I like, yeah, and we're doing all these bits. So either it's joyous or it's a nightmare because you just end up doing five full-time jobs. So I feel like there must be something in between, but I feel like it's either one of those two things.
Yeah, I would say it depending on what day of the week it is. So yeah, depending on how many like practice standards assessments I've got coming up, or how much involvement I'm needed on like the PLP, and then obviously how busy I am with the CPR training, or how much of a three-year-old my three-year-old is being at any one time. So I guess I'm yet to find the perfect role that gives me everything I want. And maybe I'm a bit greedy, and maybe I'm looking for something that's not out there. But I've also just got one of those really short attention spans where I like to be busy doing different things. And I've never really, I don't think I've found the perfect one yet.
Do you feel like this is the type of situation where you've really had to work hard at carving out the career that you want, or have these things just kind of fallen from the tree onto your lap?
Not fallen from the tree at all. No, so I do believe that you can make your career whatever you want it to be with, you know, a certain amount of luck, hard work, gumption, I guess would be a better word. No, so like I said, I think I've been lucky with the people that I've worked with, from a kind of supporting and really trying to play to people's strengths. So rather than kind of shove them into a square hole and just saying, well, get on with it. So I was very lucky that, you know, they didn't fall in my lap. So I created a static wards position at North Downs. So historically, there was no static nurses. We all rotated. We introduced supervisors, or they introduced supervisors. And then kind of working with that person, we realised that we really needed static people in our wards team, because obviously the, you know, I've been there, I was there from like literally the day it opened. So seeing like the caseload increase and what we were doing increase as well, we really needed static people. And I said, well, you know, I'm doing a horrible commute. I don't mind working 10-7 every day. And if it means that I can be static in wards, then I'll suck it up. So I did. So I did late every day of the week because I wanted to be a static nurse in wards. And then because that worked, they then introduced more static positions. But, you know, it wasn't something that just sort of fell into my lap. It was a bit like I saw an opportunity. I'm able to kind of pitch for it, demonstrated that it worked, accepted that it wasn't going to be with the best hours in the world, but actually it was in the long run going to pay off. So that's what I did. Then created a head of training because I identified a need, was able to deliver that. Then became a clinical services manager. And again, none of those roles were things that I think traditionally we'd had. So I do feel very privileged to have been given those opportunities to develop roles that actually now are becoming quite commonplace. There are heads in training in most large hospitals now. And the clinical services sort of role is, again, a lot of people are in charge of clinical governance and quality improvement. So I feel like I have worked really hard. I think to say kind of it fell from the sky, I don't know, for me it would be a bit like, well, you know, I did do quite a lot of additional qualifications. I did put myself out there with regards to my availability.
I think it's one of those things where I definitely feel like there are those people. I definitely have people in my life where I'm like, where they, it just all works out perfectly. And maybe that's one of those things, you know, like you're like, it always just happens, you know what I mean? And then I always feel like I'm like, you know, having to like scramble to make it work for me. It doesn't, you know, you've got, because I do feel like actually a lot of the opportunities you really do have to go after. Do you know what I mean? These things do. And I think that's I wasn't trying to underplay your.
No, not at all. But I don't want like it, you know, it's things like I commuted for, I did a 100-mile round trip for, I commuted for a long time because I wanted to go and work there. I've been very privileged in the fact that my husband has always been very supportive. I mean, you could argue that he should probably rein in some of my harebrained schemes sometimes, but I think having that kind of support as well, that just enables you to maybe go after things.
I love that, yeah.
Yeah, and I touched on it with Lace as well. Like I went to a grammar school and we were very, it soured me towards education in some ways, but we were always encouraged to do whatever we thought we could. Mm. We were always told, like, never settle. If you want to go and do that, go and do it. Like, it just requires hard work.
And who, where did that come from? Was that, I mean, was that teachers that told you that? Was that really?
Girls don't get C's. Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. I was quite lazy, I guess. I couldn't really be bothered, but I coasted along and did all right. And yeah, that was always very much our vibe at school was, yeah.
So do you think that, so that's a, in a positive way, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. For that overall, it was positive, but I think I've learned from that, and I'm very cautious that now with my son, and we were at the age now we were talking about schools and stuff, and I just said to Richard, I don't want him to be made sour like I was, because I feel like I was, yeah. But that said, I don't know, life is what you make it, and like I said, I do want nurses to hopefully listen and think there are many more options than what you maybe think are traditional and classic, and world is your oyster as an RBN.
So let's talk about harebrained schemes. So you've got you talked about your your husband, your poor suffering husband,
yeah.
Your poor suffering husband. We are joking, by the way. We're not supporting poor suffering husbands. No.
He's fine.
No, he's fine. Right. Exactly. They're okay. There's like an outreach program for them. So what tell me about the harebrained stuff. I want to know about that.
Oh God, really? Well, there was a whole, you know, I've worked at that referral center in the southeast. There's not really any other referral centers around here. I want a leadership role. Oh look, there's one in Cheshire. Let's go. Let's go. Pack up the oh, let's go. So off we went. So we relocated everything, moved up to Cheshire. I then decided, well, there's many other things I did in between, but I decided I wanted to run retreats. That's probably pretty up there in the harebrained scheme. In between, I think I'd gone into photography as well. So I did a lot of photography because I decided I was going to be a photographer for a small period of time. And my poor husband is able to make websites. So obviously every time I come up with a harebrained scheme, he's there building me a website, like my Evo VM platform, which is how it really started for me from a social media point of view, where I said, I want to create a bit like probably what you guys have done really well, actually, to be fair. And I never managed to do it very well, but like a platform where, you know, there were CPD for nurses by nurses and giving everyone opportunity and it not just being, you know, the same people all the time. And that didn't really work.
Let's backtrack there a little bit. I think people think that these things are easy, you know, they are not.
Really not.
No, and just because we have a requirement to do CPD in the UK, you know, everyone has to do CPD. Yeah. It's not an easy sell. You're not going to be, well, certainly I'm not a multimillionaire. I don't know about you, but I can confirm I am not a multimillionaire. So, but I think, obviously there are, you know, people making money out of delivering CPD. I think just to not deconstruct the whole thing too much, I think, you know, it's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
I would echo that. Mm. But then we've got now your creation of, I suppose what is in essence CPD, CPD delivery that you're doing now. And do you want, let's just tell people a little bit about that, about the retreats and about the CPR stuff.
Yeah, so that, we can blame Vetstagram for that. I had a bit of a epiphany. Well, I was really miserable at Vetstagram because I'd spent all of Vetstagram listening to people with their whys and their clarity and their really clear goals. And I'd been to an Anything Is Possible event as well the same weekend that Katie very kindly sorted out for me. So I'd been surrounded by all these like really focused, inspiring people. And I am not focused. I can be if I have to be, but generally speaking, I'm quite a creative person. So I tend to have quite a large thought process. So I was sat there thinking, oh, I've just failed everything, haven't I? Like, this is just an actual disaster. Like, I started Evo, not really being anything. I don't really know what the point of any of this is. Why do I even bother making content? Why am I spending hours drawing these pictures? And then really thought about the thing that I feel really passionate about that I can really home in on. So rather than trying to be like good at everything, because, you know, I'm not in the clinical practice as much anymore. I have a child, you know, maybe 10 years ago I could have done all that stuff, but let's be honest, I can't. And it's sometimes having a bit of a reality check, which is not always the most fun. I was in a really bad mood. I was like really, really grumpy.
And this was you where you'd created the nurse page that was more to do with CPD delivery.
And like empowering and like messaging and, you know, all of that. Yeah. Just like a platform, because I'm just very opinionated, so I quite like a platform, but I also quite really want to help nurses believe they can do what they want to do. I just felt like sometimes I feel we're so downtrodden as a profession that it's really nice to just hear people doing things well. So anyway, but that was really going very well.
Just give us the, so you said the abbreviation, just tell me the full title of that. So
it was Evolution VN, which is what people still refer to me as, which is what my email is. So I'd done the whole website and we'd like,
I think so. It's what is interesting about that is, so you had created a platform that was fair enough delivering CPD. I think you did.
But then I got known for my drawings. I did the drawings because I have this really. I'm very paranoid about using pictures and photos, and I don't want to use patient pictures because I just think, oh God, like in 10 years' time, disaster. So, but then I got known for the pictures.
Yeah.
It wasn't really what I wanted to be known for. I didn't want to be known for like drawing pictures. Like, yes, I draw pictures, but I do that in my own time. Like, that's my thing I enjoy. So, which is why I felt really like lost, was because like, oh God, why is this going? So anyway, then I was obviously at Vetstagram, whatever, and thought, well, that's it. I deleted everything. I deleted all my social media. Yeah, I did on the train home. Deleted everything.
So hold on one second. So just to start, you know, because I think this is really again, I hate, in, it is interesting, not in a bad or good way, just in a kind of interesting way, because
I'm very honest.
So you've created this page that's about empowering people. You go to an Instagram event for veterinary professionals. Yeah. You are surrounded by people that are
incredible.
Incredible. Yeah. And you, on the way home, you delete that page.
Yeah.
Delete
them.
I don't.
It took me hours to delete all these posts. I tell you.
The time involved with the deletion.
It was a very long train journey home, and I was with Lou, who obviously was like, got so much, I don't know, I find it very inspiring to be around, and I was wrapping it, like, delete the whole lot. Came off it, and my husband's like, what are you going to do with all your time now? You don't have social media. That's a bit glimmery, isn't it? And then just had a bit of a, like, again, Lou's been a great support to me, to be fair, and Katie, and a few people that I like, you know, just be like, bounce my random ideas off. And I'd said, I'm going to do CPR. Right, I'm going to do CPR. I need a clear, this needs to be clear. This is too blurry. Evo was never meant to be about pictures of me, which is what it's become, and I don't like that. And I don't feel like I really have anything to talk about. It was just a bit rubbish. And I had kind of already thought of the retreats prior to COVID, and I'd already done a bit of a, you know, would anybody be interested in a retreat with, you know, fellow nurses? And I hadn't, COVID happened, which killed it a little bit, but also it was a bit like, I'm quite a snob and I'm quite openly a snob, whatever, shoot me. So I like very nice hotels and very nice venues, and to try and run a veterinary retreat in a very nice place was very expensive. And I was like, oh, I can't really just like, oh, come and have a chat with us for, you know, 8 hours, not really going to sell it, is it? And then it just, I did the recover course, and I'd always loved, like, that's what I overhauled at North Downs for CPR. So I'd already done like my recover journey. So I'd completed the instructor course last summer, and I just thought, right, that's it, I'm going to do it. So I just then rebranded all of it, had to like rename an old, created a new profile, then realised that was stupid, went on the old profile, deleted all the old posts. And so I had a bit of an issue with my Facebook page because I couldn't really get rid of that. That went a bit weird. So then it became the CPR coach. So that is now what I do. So I go into practices and train them on CPR skills. So that really draws into like all the teaching stuff that I love. It uses my experience in large hospitals, it uses all my CPR training. And then for me now, I get genuinely excited about it because I think the CPR training in our profession is so bad that in a very easy 2-hour session, I make most people feel a little bit more confident about it, which is really, I always leave and I've got a smile on my face and I feel like, oh, right. You know, hopefully the next time one happens, they're not going to go home and cry into their pillow thinking they did an awful job. Hopefully they're going to realise they did the best they could do with what they had.
Well, I think based on your model, they're going to go home and cry into a really expensive luxury pillow.
Very expensive.
Boutique hotel.
Very 800 thread count, you know. yeah.
I absolutely love this model. So basically, you have combined your love of expensive hotels with your love of CPR.
Retreats are beautiful. It is a beautiful converted barn. It is, we have a chef that cooks our food for us. It is, yeah.
Listen, I'm all about it. So to be genuine about it, so you are certified as a recover instructor. You go into people's practices and teach them how to do good CPR, and you run these retreats where people can come away, and it, you know, from what I can see, it's very sort of child or particularly baby
friendly. So we've got a baby coming to the next one. We've got an assistant still coming as well. I always feel I'm always ill after congresses. I always go home and I'm exhausted, normally because I've, you know, taken advantage of happy hour and stuff like that, but I do have immune conditions as well, which don't really help, so I do have to be aware of that. And I just wanted people to go away and think, oh, that was a nice couple of days. Not like, oh my God, I need a week off to recover. But also this is where you can certify as a recover rescuer. So when you do your recover process, you do like your online training, and then you can certify as a recover rescuer, which is a full day practical, which is great fun because it's running like mega codes with strangers, which is brilliant. But when I did it, there aren't many UK instructors offering it outside of the organisations they work for. So I actually went to Estonia to do mine, which is why when I came back, I was like, I want to offer it to people. I want people to come and be able to be rescuers. I want them to be able to be certified as recover rescuers. But that does mean that it's a fairly small group because you can only really do sort of 8 to 10 people at a time. And Aurora, who has followed me on my whole recover journey, bless her, with me. Oh, she's been on. I've been like, come on, let's go to Estonia. It'll be great. Let's go to Ghent. It'll be amazing. So she runs them with me. But so I'm very lucky to have quite a lot of support.
Congratulations. And so you are now, tell us the name of the page again.
So the CPR coach.
The CPR coach. Yeah, and CPR coach. It's beautifully branded. And you... put out very consistent content with a very clear message that it's about CPR.
Yes.
Are you happy now with that? So come on now. Right. Come on now. So that's very good what you've done. And I've said that to you before. So there should be some, there should be a little bit of inner peace there saying, yes, I've done a good job. No.
I don't think I'll ever. No. Oh, it's too deep, Scott. No, I don't think I'll ever. I am one of those, I've often thought I would just really like to be happy with what I've got.
Mm.
I'd really like that. Mm. And I just always want to push things.
So are you constantly, do you mean that you're constantly thinking of what's next, what's next? Is that the kind of, yeah.
Which is exhausting. It's genuinely, I would love to not, but I just don't know how I change my brain.
And what do you think, in all seriousness, do you think you're, what are you kind of, you know, and I suppose I'm asking, I would, you know, I ask myself the same question when I'm kind of thinking about all the things that I'm, you know, in my head, is there an end goal, or does it just kind of keep, is it just a continuum of kind of goals?
Yeah, I think this is the, I think there's probably quite a lot of people that can relate sometimes as well to what you're constantly exposed to on social media. So social media for me has been great. It's going to be loads of opportunities, speaking opportunities, work opportunities. Like, I'm not knocking it, but I do think it feeds into that whole, look what everybody else is doing. Mm. Maybe I should be doing that. Maybe I could be doing that. And I don't know what the end goal is. I feel very happy with what I'm doing. I feel very fulfilled with the CPR stuff. I feel like I'm making a difference. Mm. But yeah, a little bit of me will still sort of think, oh, what else can I do? And
do you,
I don't have time, but
do you find yourself in that kind of comparison trap? Do you find yourself, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I always ask myself, as like, I always joke and say, like, I'm obviously with the PRP nurses were considerably younger than me. So I always class myself as being an older nurse now. And I do think, oh God, like if it had all been like this 10 years ago when I was seeing the thoracotomies and the brain surgery, like, oh my, I've had some great content. And I do think that quite a lot. And I think, I've just been to the park with the 3-year-old and watched him scoot down some ramps. Cool. So it's hard. You have to be like, no, like my priority is my child. It will always be my child, my family. Like, and that is ultimately what you go back to. And making a life for him and wanting him to have the best of everything. And
I think for what it's worth, and I'm sure you are surrounded with people that tell you this sort of thing, but you know, for what it's worth, I think that, you know, I definitely, you know, suffer from similar sort of things. And I think that, you know, even today, you know, I was listening to the latest episode of our podcast back, you know, and it was an episode actually I recorded a wee while ago. And we've just, for so many reasons, we've just been slow getting episodes out. And I think, and I was sitting there today thinking, God, I'm so proud of this episode because of the guest was amazing and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, I've let myself down by not, you know, prioritizing it more or doing, you know, and I think, you know, I suppose I'm constantly, you know, I you know, comparing myself to other podcasts, other veterinary podcasts, other whatever, you know, and I think that they're doing it, you know, post, you know, they're releasing more episodes than me or have more downloads than me, or other people are mentioning their podcasts. Why aren't they mentioning my podcast? And I think, and I just, and I really do have to take such a massive step back and be like, look,
it doesn't matter.
It really doesn't matter. And also matter. I'm doing what I want to do. Yes, it's
if
not,
you're happy doing it, that's what matters.
And it's just, and it, you know, I don't have, because I was looking at other podcasts, God, they've got like a theme and they're diving into like a topic. And I'm like, I don't even think about these episodes before I speak to people. And then I'm like,
maybe people like.
You know, but maybe I should, you know what I mean? But I, but again, you just have to kind of take a huge step back. And I would say, as an outsider, genuinely looking at what you've created, I think you've been very, very innovative. I think you've been very creative, and I think you have done a very good job. And I think that actually I prefer to see someone who's a human being who has, who's just trying to navigate all this other bullshit. Yeah. And I think, you know, and yeah, and at the end of the day, I think that is what, and I think most veterinary professionals will relate to that. Do you think, what gives you joy then? What gives you joy in what you do? Do you think where are the moments where you think, yeah, this is that I'm pleased that I'm doing this? You know,
professionally, it's when I leave a session. It's when I leave a teaching session, and people have said to me, "Oh my god, that was amazing!" or "Thank you so much," and that was really helpful. I definitely like the teacher's high. That gives me joy. And I've realized doing work from home for pretty much 3 years now that work from home does not bring me joy.
No.
It does not. No. You know, and I see quite a lot of, you know, threads around people saying, you know, if anyone recommend a work from home job for a vet nurse, da, 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 da. And I do think, oh, just be careful because you know, it's not all it's cracked up to be. Yes, it's convenient. And that's when you, you know, you step back and say, I can pick my son up from nursery. Happy days. You know, I am very lucky in many, many ways. But the thing that gives me joy is being in front of people and helping them feel a little bit better about something. Teaching. You know, when people go, oh, God, yeah, no, I haven't thought about that. Oh, that makes perfect sense. Or, you know, that, you know, I had someone on Friday after I did a session about human factors, and they sort of said to me, like, that, yeah, that made a lot of sense. And I want to go read about that now. So thank you so much for like letting me know about that. And that's what brings me joy professionally. I mean, I will always love critical care. Like those cases, oh, like a good critical. But I can't, for me, with what I want to be able to do with my family, working in a big hospital does not fit. Doesn't fit. So I get my joy out of helping other people.
Yeah, and I think that I worked at home for a couple of years, and you know, time and place, it was fine for what I needed at that time. But I tell you, I've been back in clinic now for the last sort of three or four months. Yeah, and do you know what? And I tell you what, I never two years ago, oh my god, saying the words, "I'm enjoying this."
Yep.
Never thought I'd say them. You know, and actually I said to someone the other day, I was it was a euthanasia actually, but it was a case that had been very complex, and I actually came away thinking, God, what a privilege this job is, you know, to have a job where I can, you know, and I've never thought that in my life.
I'm like, so excited about going back one day a week,
yeah,
doing ops, and it is, you know, I'm just like, I'm really excited about actually like using my nursing skills again. But I think, but this is maybe why I've always tried to find that perfect role. And I, in the end, have just gone with, well, let's just have loads of little jobs. And then that'll give me exactly what I need. Because that'll give me the salary of one, the flexibility of another. And then actually that's the animal contact. I mean, part of a team as well. And I think people underestimate how much being part of a team. Yes, 100%. You get the downside of being in a practice, you know, whatever. There's no perfect job. But don't underestimate a team that make you feel amazing.
100%.
They are priceless.
And the thing is, I've learned that full-time clinical practice is not for me. Like, so that's not going to, that probably won't make me happy, but doing it in the way that I'm doing it now, that honestly, huge amounts of joy. What, you know, as far as kind of, you know, you've obviously, I don't want to call you old. That's not what I'm saying.
I'm nearly 40. Don't worry, I've got a kid. I'm old.
Oh, I'm 40 in 2 weeks. Let's not talk
about it.
So,
age, isn't it?
40. Yeah, I can't.
No.
I can't stop it. But you've been in the profession for a reasonable amount of time, is what I'm trying to say. And actually,
yeah. I didn't do it from school. No, I interviewed you in the circus. I've had a very random life.
All right, back up. Stop now. Wait a minute. So that was a terrible introduction you did then, because you literally were like, I liked horses.
I did like horses. So I went
and
to
someone interview. Was like, and then someone was like, you should be a vet nurse. You missed
it.
So tell me about the circus.
Yeah, that was Spirit of the Horse. I went to go and interview. I met my poor father. So my husband's taken over from my my father, can you drive up to Manchester tomorrow morning for 8 o'clock? Why? Because I'm going for an interview to join a Spirit of the Horse, which is like a travelling circus for horses. Yeah, okay, fine. Drives me up there, have my interview, and the woman's like, oh, so you'll be breaking in like the Frisian stallions and getting them used to like, you know, ring craft and performing. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not a very good rider. Like, I don't really know why I thought I could do this, but didn't do that. So interviewed for that, wasn't very good. Did a little bit of hairdressing, dabbled in that for a bit. That didn't really go anywhere either. Did a bit of graphic design. Then next thing, Dad, can you drive me to Coventry Airport? Why? Because I'm going to Jersey. I'm going to be a dressage groom in Jersey. Right, okay. So fly over to Jersey, live in Jersey for a year, see dressage groom. And then went back, then came back and did the equine thing where I then ended up being a vet nurse. So I never wanted to do it.
Exhausted. Right, so
it's hard work, isn't it?
I love that. You're like, it's really hard work being me because all of these things, the circus, everything. Amazing. I love that. So but before the circus point, my question was going to be about just actually, and this is quite topical. I don't want to be controversial. The profession has changed.
Yes, hugely.
Good or bad?
I think we're in a period of, I'm going to sit on the fence here because I feel like we're in a sit on the fence period. So I feel like it will be very good. And I do feel like there's quite a lot of change going on with regards to kind of what nurses can do. And I think vets are so much better about kind of encouraging us to work to the maximum that we do. And I think people have really evolved and created and cultured these roles that are just, you know, 10 years ago, it was you were an RVN and then you were a head nurse. And that was literally it. And if you didn't want to be a head nurse, you're an RVN. And I remember being told, like, we don't have part-time nurses. Like, things like that, being told, we don't have part-time nurses. You know, get the times, guys. Like, we're all female. Most of us are female, aren't we, in the nursing profession? So we're going to have children. And as the females, we generally do most of the childcare, unfortunately. It's a sad reality. Like, you know, it just is. And yes, there are obviously men in the profession, and I see a lot more men coming through now, which again is really good and a massive positive step, because I think it's been seen as that kind of woman nurturing role, and now actually it's a skilled profession with huge opportunity starting to be recognized as but we're not really there yet. You know, we're in a really we're in a bit of a funny place where I think maybe we'd have been better off if COVID hadn't happened. I don't know. Luckily or unluckily, I don't know how you want to word it, I was sat at home on my Todd, having no interaction whilst 9 months pregnant. But that said, I know a lot of people who were in practice who were on their knees. And I don't know if there's a little bit of a hangover from that. But unfortunately as well, the amount of skills that we bring to the table and the amount that we do, and we generate income, but we never charge. We never, like, you know, when you look at a bill, it will always be under a vet's name. It will never be under a nurse's name. So that is still, for me, one of the things where I feel like what we bring to the table is so often, like, hidden a little bit. And maybe if it was seen and we actually did price what we did, maybe things would change. I don't know. I think salaries obviously are always a bit controversial. They are improving. But then I'm also quite shocked when I see what a lot of new grad vets are on, because for what we do, you know, I always joke to my husband, like, I should have gone into IT if I wanted money, because that is where it is. But how ridiculous is that, that something that doesn't matter about life or death or making something better is where you get your money? And if you want to go into a job for the salary, you don't tell anyone to go into veterinary.
I think, you know, there's been stuff in the media, veterinary media recently, about, you know, certain corporates raising the nursing.
But then they have improved things, like from mat leave, don't forget things. So sick pay, mat leave. You know, it's getting there.
Oh yeah, but I think you're right across the board. It's not, no one's going to be a million. I mean, my first salary as a new grad vet was 27,500. Like, I don't, you know, I mean, it's, no one's going to be a millionaire.
But I always say to people, and I talk about this stuff, I go to colleges, the time I was the most happiest in my career was not when I was on the most money.
Yes, right. But that's so true.
Like, not when I was on the most money.
Nope. That is my first job was with the PDSA. Best job ever had. Yep. Best job ever had.
Loved it. Love the team. Love what you're doing. I bet. All of that.
100%. And I thought I was rich at that time. I remember.
Money didn't really matter, because I could pay what I needed. Yeah. And I had a lovely time.
Yeah. I remember getting, Andy and I just met, and we'd gone on this holiday to America, this big holiday, and we were in Vegas. I remember checking, it can't have been my phone. Things were not that advanced. No. I was checking something.
I have gone to the cash points,
those things. Yeah, yes, I probably was it. But I remember seeing my first wage from the PDSA come through, and I think it was like £600 or something. And I thought it was like, I mean, I thought like I'd absolutely made it. Do you know?
Oh, yeah, like going from a student nurse to full time, like going to go to work. I was like laughing, brilliant.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right.
But I do like, we do talk about money a lot, and I know it's important, and I know I'm very lucky to, you know, be okay. But I do sometimes say to people, you know, you can't always put a high salary with joy, because yes, a high salary will be, you know, will pay for other things and it will relieve other pressure. But the most shock satisfaction I've ever had in my job was not the highest paid role.
And the most unhappy I was in the veterinary profession was when I was being paid the most.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, it's, I mean, absolutely fact, you know, right. So, and that's, I'm sure other people can relate to that. Like, you know, that sort of thing for sure. So I think, yeah, we're in this kind of challenging. I liked what you said there, though, about kind of, you know, seeing that role of nurses changing. I really like that kind of, and I think there's so many exciting things to come for the nursing profession as far as they
feel like vets have got our backs as well. The ones that, so I, again, always been very lucky. I've always interacted with, you know, vets who have always seen us as a team and always been very pro nursing and positive and getting, and I like that. I think that's great that together we're hopefully going to create something that's got a bit more longevity than what it currently does.
And I've been very lucky. I've always worked in very, very nurse-led environments. Yes, and I think, you know, and I was locuming at Paragon, part of the Linnaeus group. And they, honestly, the nurses, I mean, I remember having a conversation with one of the nurses, and she was like, how do you feel about, you know, our kind of flow managers and different things? And I was like, listen, I don't know where you think I've come from, but I'm very used to you telling me what, like, I'm fine with this. Like, whatever, this model works for me. You know, my husband, you know, I've my whole career, nurses have just guided me through and told me where to be.
What time?
And do this now, please. Yeah. Thank you. And then please leave now because you're just becoming irritating. And I think, but literally that has been, I've been so lucky. That has been how my career has been. I tell you what, that works very well for me. And you know who it works better for? Our patients. Because they benefit more from that model than they do other models. And I think what I would say about nurses like you, other nurses that come to mind are Lou and Laura, vet internal medicine nursing, where you are really showing nurses what you can do. And so I think, say that again,
you can do so yeah, you just have to not listen to the, like, I don't know, our qualification is an amazing qualification, because you asked me would I do it again, and I've been thinking about that ever since.
And well oh god, I feel like let's leave that to the very end.
That'd be the like goodbye.
Yeah, after all this. So so I think on that kind of note, I think maybe as much as you have, and I'm really appreciating you sort of saying, you know, insecurities about social media and the way that things, you know, other people, what they're doing, but actually you will inspire people in the profession, you know, and you won't even know it, you know, as far as kind of what you've done with your qualification. And I think that's really a very powerful message. I would be interested to know who inspires you?
Obviously, I love Lou, but I love Lou anyway, because I think she took something that nobody was doing and went for it. Laura is always, our paths have crossed previously. I always find it really lovely seeing what she's doing now. And she is, I look at her and I think, oh, it's kind of the nurse I wish I could be. Like, she inspires me hugely. Because I think what she's doing, where she's going, you know, the academy, the stuff she's done is like mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. Mind-blowing. Very impressive. I always look up to Helen Silver.
Oh,
lovely Helen. Only because that stuff was never really talked about when we were baby nurses. And I was probably quite a bad baby nurse from a, you know, civility and, you know, didn't have necessarily have the best sort of manager role models to look up to. And I think a lot of the stuff that she talks about now, I think, is so powerful and applicable to what we do in practice. Yeah, they're probably my main three. Obviously, Andrea, who can you not forget Andrea? Somebody who has done amazing things with our profession, and her backstory as well, I think, is just really inspiring. But yeah, I think I get a lot of my inspiration from social media, to be fair. Yeah, there's a few of them. But to be fair, but also, like I said, the where I get joy and the most like support and stuff from is actually from people on people I just go meet. Met some amazing nurses training that have just, they've been so eager and they've been so keen, and you just think, oh my God, yes. You jazz me up and make me want to do more of this. So yeah, there's lots of inspiring nurses out there. We're very lucky. And I always think nurses today are very lucky. I know social media, like we said before, has bad things, but to have all of these opportunities presented to them and highlighted to them, you know, it's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, I really think, and I'm very inspired by very many of the nurses I have met, 100%. And a lot of that, again, is through social media. Again, it's the good and the bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Particularly, I think, you know, speaking to the younger vet nurses that are maybe listening, you know, what a piece of advice would you give to them?
There will always be compromise. Be what I'd say to them. And this is because I feel like sometimes we're led to believe we can have it all, and there is always a trade-off and a compromise. So you can have it, you can work part-time, you can have a senior role, you can have a static role, you can do whatever it is you really want to do with your qualification, but there will be compromise, and it's being aware of that and I think working with that. So that's kind of my main thing I try and tell them, is absolutely have high goals, absolutely dream big, fine, but let's be honest, we can't work 9 till 2 Tuesday to Thursday on 60 grand a year. Do you know what I mean? We have to be a little bit realistic. If there's something we really want to go for, be prepared to have a compromise, and it might be a short-term compromise, and that's fine, and you'll always be compromising things. Your compromises will always change as well, so your core things you want to get out of a role will change throughout your career, and that is okay. I'm at the point now where I want flexibility. I do need a certain salary because I paid for my child to go to nursery, and that cost, you know, those are things I want. And I've had to compromise on the really cool clinical cases that make get my blood going. I've had to compromise on that because that doesn't really fit what I need right now. And that's okay. And it's not to say that in 10 years' time or in 5 years' time, when maybe he's at school, that I can be actually, do you know what? I can drop that one now and I can pick that thing back up because I'm in a position now where I can do that. But I think if you're constantly going to be expecting everything, you're always going to be disappointed.
I think that is very, very good advice. And I think it's very, very, and very true, actually. It's very true. And I think that, again, it's just about expectation setting. And I think if you have that in your mind, right, you're not going to be as disappointed, you know?
No, I wanted to be a static nurse. I had to work late shifts. I did it because that was my end goal. And it's also thinking about what that end goal is and how are you going to get there. And yes, it might not be necessarily the easiest journey or the most straightforward journey, but if you keep that goal in mind, all of those little things will feed into it. You know, the times I sat there writing up the RCVS knowledgeable paperwork, and that sort of stuff doesn't come naturally to me, but I did that because I wanted that to be part of the clinical governance role.
Sure.
A bit smart about stuff as well.
So talking about the end goal, what are you going to be when you grow up?
When I grow up? Oh, God, I don't know. Andrew asked me at my interview, and I was like, I literally have no idea. I would like, I think realistically, I probably want to work for myself in the end. But I would like to be a consultancy type person who supports and guides practices into upskilling nurses, quality improvement, you know. I feel we're very lucky in Froyle, we have a lot of people that do that. And I think sometimes actually having somebody general that other people can just draw on would be really useful. So that would I think that's in my head what I want it to be. So still involved in veterinary. Well, I mean, if I could do it all again, I'd be a trauma surgeon, I think, coming out of helicopters, but my brain would probably say I wouldn't be doing that in 5 years either. But yeah, for myself, supporting people, helping others, teaching, guiding, sharing knowledge, but in a kind of you know, a supportive way, but we'll see.
I look forward to watching that journey unfold.
I will change. I'll be going and doing, I don't know, nail technician or something. That'll be my next.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. Yeah. And the one I go to is always busy. I mean, I think it's a in-demand situation.
Beauty always is.
Yeah, right. You should start to the circus, but that's just my opinion.
Would have been awful. Okay.
So that leaves us with, if you were to, you know, wind back time and to make this decision again, would you make the decision to qualify as a veterinary nurse?
I feel really disloyal saying this, but I don't know that I would have.
Mm-hmm.
Only because I find it really odd that we expect 14-year-olds really to decide what they want to do. I had no freaking clue. No thought. And I didn't know that, like, you know, there was anesthesia specialists. I didn't know that there were trauma surgeons. I didn't know that you could do like interventional cardiology. Like, but part of me thinks I would have done something like that, and I probably would have done it in the human sector, and I'd have done something quite hardcore, quite adrenaline. I think I'm an adrenaline junkie. In reality, is probably where I get my high from. But then I think all the people I've met and all the things I've done have been because of nursing. So would I necessarily scrap all that? I don't know that I would. Yeah. I've met some of my like mum friends, my vet friends, the friends I've got, and the things I've done and the opportunities I've had have been from vet nursing.
Mm-hmm. It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because I think, and again, you know, who says that we have to have one career that's our only career, you know? Yeah, get rid of that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think it's true, isn't it? You know, I think that that's the other problem, you know, that we kind of bed in and then that's it.
Yeah, 14. That's what I said I was going to get.
And again, if you can't, you know, if you can't see it, you can't be it. Like, I think if you know, and you can't know about all the nuances of all the different possibilities at 14, 15, 16, 17, you know. And so I think that it's impossible to make that decision at that stage, I think, you know.
I've got a HMC in graphic design because I was going to be a graphic designer and then realised I didn't really want to be a graphic designer.
Of course you do. That is, of all the things you've said, that surprises me the least.
It's obvious, but I didn't like being told what to draw, so I didn't want to do it. So I don't like being told.
Okay.
You probably got that vibe as well.
I feel like that's another podcast right there, that... I mean, I'm really good at this thing, but I don't want to be told what to do, so I'm not.
I'm not gonna do it at all.
Yeah. That's like a whole other. That's a whole other.
You can ask my ex-boss about that.
Okay, I'll get them on the next episode.
So I'll work myself. Yeah.
No, but listen, I think, you know, it's interesting. That's why I work for myself, but I don't. Funny you say that, because recently, you know, I was thinking, God, you know, am I happy working for myself? Am I more happy working for myself because maybe I'm really difficult to manage or really difficult to, like, you know, and I don't think that's necessarily true. You know, sometimes but I do like working for myself and generally making decisions and being.
It's the freedom, isn't it?
Freedom, the creative. And again, the creative freedom, the because I get to say, like, even Andy sending me 10 images today for our cardio course, and I got to say, well, actually, no, I like that Cavalier King Charles better than that one, you know. But it's stuff like that that I enjoy, like being involved in building a website. I'm certainly not building the website, but I'm telling them what I want the website to be like, you know. And I think I get that vibe from you. You're clearly creative, but also you have a very, very strong brand, and I think that clearly comes from someone that knows that stuff too, you know. So but that's important to exercise that part of your brain, as well as your clinical part, as well as your trauma surgeon part, as well as your, do you know what I mean?
I think that's why I've ended up with the, when someone says, because some people I say, oh, you're not working at all, because the last thing they knew, I had a bit of a, well, that's a whole other episode, but like my son had surgery last year. So I had a bit of a, like, you know, very, very low point after his surgery, and kind of, again, jacked in everything, because I'm a bit all or nothing, so jacked in everything, and now I ended up with four jobs, but actually, well, four or three, like, sometimes five depending on the child, but like I said, I think I've kind of picked the bits that give me what I need now at this moment in time. And I've added to them. So I wasn't doing this many 6 months ago. And then I was like, actually, I quite fancy doing that. Actually, I do think next year I want to go and work in practice. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to have that lined up for next year. So I think having that freedom to just tailor make something is really wonderful.
Okay, so just picking up our discussion about the really the management of acute diarrhea in dogs and cats, particularly focusing on dogs, to be honest, in this segment. But last time we ended with a conclusion that really we have relatively good evidence now that the using antibiotics in cases of acute, uncomplicated diarrhea is really not indicated. And we know, you know, historically, And just to set the context again, we really are talking about cases of acute diarrhea, and it could be hemorrhagic, you know, hemorrhagic or not, particularly in dogs, particularly when they are not systemically unwell, generally speaking, reaching for the antibiotics. And as I said, historically, particularly reaching for metronidazole as an antibiotic is not really warranted. And we have a number of studies that kind of show that. One of the things that often gets kind of banded around or touted about, is that a phrase? Is that metronidazole is useful in cases of diarrhea or GI disease because metronidazole has an effect on the immune system. It has some sort of immune modulatory effect. And this is not... you know, this is not just cases of acute diarrhea, but this is actually also maybe cases of chronic diarrhea, chronic enteropathy, where people are wanting to consider using antibiotics. And a lot of these chronic enteropathies are maybe immune mediated, and, you know, people will then sort of potentially, you know, want to reach for the antibiotics in those cases. I think, does metronidazole have an effect on the immune system? There are some studies that, you know, you can have a look at different things, human and animal, but a lot of kind of in vitro stuff, so in the lab type experiments where, you know, potentially metronidazole does have an effect on cell mediated immunity. It maybe does inhibit white blood cell or function, or modulate white blood cell function in some sort of way. I think the question is, is that benefit enough to justify using metronidazole in that way? And I think honestly the answer is no. So do we have some evidence, some studies that suggest that there may be some effect in the immune system of metronidazole? The answer is yes. Is that enough to justify routinely using metronidazole in cases of diarrhea in dogs and cats? I would say absolutely not. So that's not a clear cut. That sentiment about metronidazole affecting the immune system has come from somewhere, but I don't think we have enough to be saying, well, that's a really strong reason to be using it routinely, because again, of all of the detrimental effects that we spoke about, as far as selecting for resistant bacteria, the negative effect it has on the microbiome, then it far outweighs any potential effect that metronidazole might have, you know, in that way. One of the other, just before we move on to something a bit more, or a bit different, probiotics. You know, the choice of going back to that choice of antibiotics, particularly in acute diarrhea, you know, metronidazole is often chosen versus things like amoxicillin clavulonic acid. I think 100% there's no benefit. You know, when they compare different types of antibiotics in the management of acute diarrhea, there really is no benefit of one over the other either. So we shouldn't, it's not, I think we're generally not missing a trick with one antibiotic versus the other. We just shouldn't be using antibiotics at all. Okay, so let's move on to talk about something slightly different. So what about probiotics? And that's certainly something that has become more and more popular in the management of acute diarrhea. And it would seem very sensible to, you know, consider that the bacterial population is going to be disrupted in cases of diarrhea, and therefore doing something to help with that definitely sounds like a really positive thing to do. Just a little bit of nomenclature that I want to go over first of all, because I think the problem with a lot of the probiotic, prebiotic, postbiotic products is that they're often not regulated like some, you know, prescription medications. You can buy them on the internet, over the counter. The formulations are really variable. So I think it's important to understand kind of what you're getting with probiotics. Probiotics, by definition, are live microorganisms, which ultimately we're giving to, you know, confer a health benefit. Other things that actually are in many of these products that are called probiotics, but actually maybe just as beneficial in some ways, are things like prebiotics, which are supplements, usually sort of fiber, carbohydrate type additions that may have a positive effect on the growth of microorganisms. And postbiotics are potentially are bacterial products that are non-viable, so non-living bacterial products that have a beneficial effect on the host. And synbiotics are products that contain probiotics and prebiotics. So I think probably the most important part for me there is that a lot of these diets that have a positive effect in the microbiome and products that are marketed as probiotics often will have quite beneficial prebiotics in them as well. I think the main thing to say about probiotic products is that the vast majority of human studies, and there's going to be a lot more human studies than there is dog studies, is that there's not massive safety concerns about them. And this is one of the things that I'm always thinking about when I'm deciding to use any medication or supplement is, you know, do we have a load of evidence to say that it works? Often we don't. But then again, if we are going to use it, what's the potential harm that I might do? And the reassuring thing about the probiotic type preparations is that they are relatively safe. So few examples of negative effects, so not massive contraindications. But I think we've got to be comfortable with the fact that the evidence for using probiotics in acute or chronic diarrhea is still lacking. And one of the major issues with looking at probiotics is that when you look at the studies, it's hard to get consistency. So comparing one study against the other is really, really difficult because every study uses a different preparation, a different strain, and that makes the comparison very, very difficult. I think the take-home message is that there are growing studies looking at probiotic products in acute and chronic diarrhea, and there is some evidence building for their use. Okay, is that strong? Is that consistent? Maybe not. But certainly, we would be encouraged with their use in acute diarrhea and potentially chronic diarrhea cases. And these studies are looking at different things. They're looking at fecal scores, they're looking at duration of disease, and often what the probiotics are doing is reducing the severity of disease and potentially reducing the amount of time that it takes for these patients to resolve their clinical signs. So some examples would be that we have, you know, some studies that actually not necessarily directly confer strong benefit to having the probiotic in the mix, but actually some studies that show that when compared with things like antibiotics like metronidazole, the metronidazole group don't get better any quicker. So, you know, we have to look at the studies and kind of what the various conclusions are, but certainly overall there would seem that there is a beneficial effect to using probiotics. So an example of a study would be that there, so one of the probiotics that we might use quite a lot in practice would be something like Procolon, so the Procolon Advanced product. There is a study looking at the administration of that. You know, the conclusion there is potentially the acceleration of the reduction of acute diarrhea in dogs and cats with the administration of that particular product. There's other studies looking at probiotics in cases of parvoviral enteritis, Tritrichomonas fetus in cats. And then, you know, some studies looking at probiotics in more chronic diarrhea cases. So let's not focus on any one of them. I think that the take-home messages there is lots of options as far as probiotics. I think what we can conclude when we look at all the evidence on balance, when we're considering treatment of acute uncomplicated diarrhea, probiotics are likely a better choice, so they're unlikely to cause harm. They almost certainly will shorten recovery time in some cases, but better than antibiotics and not going to cause the detrimental effects that antibiotics can cause by you know, the bacterial resistance and the dysbiosis. So probiotics are almost certainly a better choice than antibiotics in these cases. Exactly which probiotic to use, that will depend a little bit on what's available to you, etc., etc. And I think we will learn more and more as time goes on whether there is one that is really stand out better from the other. But ultimately, the probiotic is still going to be a better choice than the antibiotic. Okay, so just to finish up today, I want to just go back to the case that we were discussing in the last episode. So Pablo, who's a 2-year-old Pomeranian with acute diarrhea, no improvement with probiotics and diet change. So he came into the clinic. He was, you know, systemically well with acute diarrhea. He got some probiotics and he got a gastrointestinal diet, which is, I think, a great choice. Sent on his way, came back because the owner noticed more fresh blood in the diarrhea. The diarrhea did not resolve and he actually started to vomit. His heart rate elevated to 140 beats per minute and his rectal temperature elevated to 39.6. So we've got a persistence of clinical signs in this little dog that initially was kind of not that unwell. We've got some blood in the diarrhea, but we've also now got vomiting. We've got an increase in heart rate and temperature. So this is the kind of situation where we do start to think a little bit differently. So, you know, are we going to, in this sort of situation, give 5 days of metronidazole orally? Are we going to maybe repeat some blood work? He initially had blood work and that was relatively unremarkable. Are we going to hospitalize him for intravenous fluids? Are we going to perform abdominal ultrasound? And I think these are the cases where I don't think we necessarily are immediately going to be thinking about giving antibiotics, but I think we want to start to think about what investigations might be appropriate in a case of acute diarrhea that is starting to become unwell. What else are we going to do? Things that are available in the vomiting and diarrhea dog are things like ultrasound, radiography, biochemistry, hematology, electrolytes, gastrointestinal bloods like, you know, basal cortisol, folate, cobalamin, TLI, fecal analysis. So I think, you know, I think that's what I want us to think about for next time. So we've decided in these cases of acute diarrhea, we're not going to reach for the antibiotics. We're probably going to give a probiotic. We're probably going to give, you know, do some diet change to a GI diet. But my question is, when you do that, which is the right thing to do, and they come back and they're not getting better, if not becoming a little bit more unwell, what are going to be the next steps in our investigation and how are we going to manage these patients? And we'll pick that up in the next episode. A massive thank you again to Sam for chatting today. And as always, a huge thank you to you for listening. We are just grateful that you do tune in. If you do want any more information about VTX and what we do, then head over to our website, which is www.vtx-cpd.com, and do check out the show notes for all the exciting stuff that Sam is getting up to as well. We'd love to hear your feedback about the podcast, so please do drop me an email for any suggestions of people that you'd like to hear on the podcast, but also just general feedback. It's always much appreciated. And you can email us at info@vtx-cpd.com. So thank you again for taking the time to listen, and we'll see you all next time.